Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. In fact, Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/podcastfree. All lowercase, shopify.com/podcastfree, shopify.com/podcastfree.
Tonight on The Readout.
You see these bums, you know, blowing up the campuses. Listen, the boys that are on the college campuses today are the luckiest people in the world. And here they are burning up the books. I mean, storming around about this issue. I mean, you name it. Get rid of the war, there'll be another one.
President Richard Nixon in 1970 referring to student war protesters as bums, just 3 days before four students were shot dead by the Ohio National Guard at Kent State. And once again, we're seeing the cycle repeating itself as universities and police departments clamp down on campus protests. Also tonight, how Trump's lawyers are appealing more to their clients' vanity and less to the judge and the jury, and why that is a losing strategy. Plus, was there ever any doubt that Ron DeSantis would be back in Trump's loving embrace? He's one of many former Trump critics now scrambling to get back into his good graces. But we begin tonight with a question about a long-standing protection supposedly afforded by the U.S. Constitution. Namely, what rights do you have to protest in America? We assume a lot because of the First Amendment, right? But what if you're trying to exercise your free speech rights on a university campus? What if your views are unpopular, or at least in the minority of the general public? It turns out, if you're protesting war, your rights are pretty limited. In the 1960s and 70s, during the Vietnam War, we had anti-war protests around the country. And those protests are now enshrined as one of the most pervasive displays of opposition to the U.S. government in modern times. Young people protested against the expansion of the war, the draft, the use of napalm, the chemical gas that had become a symbol of the war in Vietnam. These protests were large and intense, and in some cases, violent. There were shootings on college campuses like Kent State University, where the Ohio National Guard shot and killed four unarmed college students during a rally opposing the expanding involvement of the Vietnam War into Cambodia. That shooting is set to mark its 54th anniversary this Saturday. Days later, also in 1970, in a lesser-known incident, police opened fire on students during a protest at Jackson State College, the historically black college in Mississippi. Here you see bullet holes at a women's dormitory where police officers fired into a crowd around the dormitory, killing two and wounding 15 students. To open fire on unarmed students just shows you the kind of contempt the state had for those opposing the war, a war in which men the students' age were dying. It's part of this historical opposition to the idea of being against a war from Vietnam to Iraq. You saw consistent patterns of disparaging anti-war protesters. Students in the 1960s being told to join the Viet Cong, or anti-Iraq war protesters accused of being pro-Al-Qaeda, despite Al-Qaeda having nothing to do with Iraq. You also saw it with anti-apartheid protesters, which is a little different, not a war, but a situation containing elements of war, like colonization. And let's not forget the cruel disregard for black life during the civil rights movement, which went hand in hand with the anti-war movement, especially when Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. delivered a speech condemning the Vietnam War. It's easy now to assume that most Americans opposed the war in Vietnam. But at the time, they didn't. Ditto on Iraq. Well, now we're seeing a similar type of backlash against those who oppose the Israeli offensive in Gaza, including the deployment by university leaders, in some cases, of overwhelming state police force. The message is clear. The government and university presidents want you to know that the right to protest is a farce. You can be tear gassed, shot with rubber bullets, tackled and thrown to the ground and arrested. At Emory University, a shocking scene unfolded as Atlanta police and Georgia state troopers arrested protesters and released chemical agents on campus. At least two videos have emerged of Emory professors getting arrested. This is Professor Noel McAfee, who will join us in a few moments. The use of police force against these protesters should alarm you. And it mirrors the violence that is happening in Israel, with police responding to anti-war protesters there as well. You have to wonder why. Why would the state line up against our students who are the future, especially young people like these who are at some of the most prestigious universities in America, doing exactly what one is supposed to do in college, which is to think critically, stand up for what they believe in, and demand a better world. Students who are speaking out against atrocities they are seeing abroad, a war where Palestinians are getting killed in airstrikes in areas that the Israeli military designated as safe zones. They're watching children starve while workers bringing desperately needed food are killed by sniper drones. Potential war crimes so appalling that Israel fears its leaders could soon face arrest warrants from the International Criminal Court. These actions are what these young people are protesting, as they did in reaction to Vietnam and the Iraq War and during the Civil Rights Movement and against South African apartheid. We have seen this story play out before. Only this time, it stems from the unrest that began largely at New York's Columbia University, where university officials gave the pro-Palestinian demonstrators a 2 p.m. deadline today and threatened to suspend them if they did not leave. But it's obvious that it's not dying down. As of tonight, the tents remain. But Columbia said it has started suspending students who defied the deadline. Joining me now from Columbia University is NBC News correspondent Antonia Hilton. Antonia, please give us the latest on what's happening there.
Hey, Joy. Well, you just said it. The encampment is very much here. Not only are all the tents still up, but students are inside gathering, meeting, talking about what they expect to happen next. I've spoken to some students as well as faculty members, and faculty are a critical piece of this because many of them have started wearing these bright neon yellow vests and standing around the encampment to send a signal to administration or potentially to the NYPD if they were to return that they're standing with their students. And what they tell me is that they're concerned about what's about to happen tonight or into the early hours of tomorrow. And that's because of this 2 p.m. deadline. It came and it went. And what we saw happen around 1 o'clock was that there were the protests led by the core students who are involved in this encampment day after day. But hundreds of other students joined them. This entire historic lawn, this section at the center, the heart of the campus, was full of students chanting and marching all around the campus together, including many hundreds of students who, again, are not part of this core team, but who wanted to show up and show the administration we're on our classmates' side in this. There was also a small pro-Israel rally that came out behind where I am right now to show support for their side. But the overwhelming majority of students here have been showing, at least in physical and in public spaces, that they're on the side of the students in this encampment. Even some students told me that while they might mourn what could happen to graduation or how it might look different if the encampment is still present, that because of all the global forces that you just described, in a way they feel they can't even make it about themselves. They've started somewhat of a movement, they tell me. They see encampments spreading from Massachusetts to Indiana and Tennessee and California. And because this is seen as the epicenter, a lot of these students are now separating into two groups. The students who are going to risk arrest, suspension, or maybe even expulsion, and the students who won't and who may pack up their belongings tonight and make a plan so that they can be part of commencement or they can just make sure that they graduate this semester and stay in good standing. But I expect to see tomorrow what we're going to be back here on the ground again, even as the encampment potentially shrinks. That's still an open question. Yeah. I think you'll see a lot of students standing around in solidarity with their classmates, Joy.
Very quickly, before I let you go, Antonia, what do we know about the organizers of that encampment?
Well, it's a decentralized power structure. So there are several leaders, several organizers, and they're of all faiths. There are Muslim students. There are Jewish students who are key, crucial core organizers here as part of this encampment. And some of the students are undergraduates. Some of the leadership are graduate school students. And a lot of the time they spend the day doing activities. They'll go to their classes, do their homework. They have a library where students can read and learn about the Middle East and all kinds of incidents in the past. They can debate with each other. They'll bring in faculty members who sometimes talk to them about these issues from their perspective. And they also engage with faculty who actually don't always agree with them on everything. The faculty supporting them often are supporting them just from a principle of free speech, not mm-hmm. because they necessarily agree with all the student demands. They just don't want to see the NYPD return and their students be treated this way, they tell me, Joy.
NBC's Antonia Hilton doing some of the best reporting, such a valuable journalist, and we need more people to be doing what you're doing, actually out there talking to students and doing the real work. Antonia Hilton, thank you. Enough respect. Thank you very much. Let's bring in Emory University professor Noelle McAfee, who we just showed you earlier being arrested, and Jelani Cobb, dean of the Columbia University School of Journalism and an MSNBC contributor. Thank you both for being here. I do want to start at the table with you, Jelani. Graduation is coming up at Columbia very mm-hmm. soon. What do you know about the negotiations with these students, because they have not yet left this encampment?
Well, they reached an impasse, and so there are some core issues. There's kind of a kind of immovable space almost between where the students are and where the administration is. And so I can't talk sure. about any particulars in there.
Yeah. And, I mean, the thing is, this is an anti-war protest in the classic sense. They are literally against a war and are being met with police brutality. But this is happening all over the country. At Emory, they use tear gas on students. Just talk about the historic context a little bit of that.
Yeah, I will add one thing here, which is that the real kind of fulcrum here is also graduation.
Yes.
And so there's the free speech side of it. And there's also an array of voices from other students, some of whom are okay if graduation doesn't happen because they are so supportive of this, many of whom are not.
Some of whom did not get to do school during the pandemic.
Some of whom did not get to have a high school graduation.
Yeah.
And so that is the kind of complex. And then there are a lot of parents and
sure.
other kind of dynamics there. So it's more simple. It's more complicated than just the straightforward thing.
But, and we have to recognize this is an international center of learning. So people have flown in from other countries to go to graduation.
Right.
So there's the question of whether or not graduation has to take place on that same space, I'm assuming.
Right. That's exactly one of the spaces where graduation is held. So that's been one of the kind of core issues that also aggravates the debate that's happening here.
Sure.
Now, in terms of context, there's some real crucial precedents, because when I was walking across campus, I think 2 days ago, a gentleman came up to me and told me that he had helped organize the 1985 occupation, which pushed Columbia to become the first university that divested from companies doing business in South Africa. And he was talking about the parallels and the divergences and the things that he saw that were different and things that he thought were kind of precedents that should be copied in this situation. But the real thing that people are thinking about, certainly people who are thinking about Columbia's history, is the anti-war protest of 1968, which was the huge one that you know, actually a series of protests that generated so much conflict and so much strife in the course of them that there had been a half century precedent of never calling the NYPD back to campus.
Yeah.
And
until now.
Until now.
And I mean, and calling the police on your own students. I want to get you into this, Professor McAfee. You know, to me, it feels like a bridge that one would think that knowing the history, knowing that this is a history that is on tape, that one can play back. The violent history of using the police to suppress dissent on campus. Yet, university after university is not just doing it, but escalating it. I would say that your university escalated it using tear gas, using chemical agents on students. Talk about your experience and why you were arrested.
Yeah, thank you, Joy. This is an honor to be here. Can I just tell you a little anecdote first? It's a great
sure.
contrast to what's happening now. There, a friend and mentor, David Matthews, was the youngest president of the University of Alabama several decades ago, and he had gone on a trip, and he came back to his office as president of the university, and there were students sitting down occupying his office. And what he did is he sat down with them, and he called in the Student Government Association president. And he had weeks of sitting down on the floor with these students, talking with them. And in higher education, we should be teaching our students how to think, how to engage, how to do politics in a constructive way. So to go to your question, I had been in my office and wanted to go check on the students. And I knew from the past that Emory liked to just call in the police. I wanted to make sure they hadn't done that. I thought they learned something. So I came down there, and they had called in the police, and they not just Emory, but the Atlanta police. And then as I'm standing there, I see the Georgia troopers marching in. And when they got in position, they just attacked the students. They had ambushed them, they attacked them, and their mission was to clear the quad. And they did that. So, and I went to jail. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, just brief. They let me out. So, but I mean, this is not how to educate students. If we live in a world that's already so hyper-polarized and we can't think beyond these extreme positions. So I think it's just tragic. It's on so many levels, but on the big political level, this is not the way to teach citizenship.
I want to show just a couple of things. So we've had the police have now broken up an Israeli Gaza protest at the University of Georgia campus in Athens, Georgia. This is all taking place today as Vice President Kamala Harris is actually in Atlanta today. To stay with you, Professor, for a moment, a lot of the anger that's coming out of these Georgia campuses is not just about Gaza. It's about Cop City. It's about police training that is actually joint training between the IDF in Israel and Georgia police. And so it's also an anti-police violence protest, too. Can you talk a bit about that dynamic? Because what these students are asking for is divestment from that kind of police training, Cop City, and investments in military.
Yes. And just think about it. These students are fighting something that the Atlanta Police Department is orchestrating. And Emory brings in the Atlanta Police Department. So we're going to get, there were students tear gassed, pummeled, that were standing by. There was another professor who didn't even know anything was a demonstration going by. She wanders by and sees police pummeling somebody, gets between them, and she was in jail overnight.
Yeah. Let me play for you what's happening in UCLA just for a moment. Sorry, we're running short on time, so I want to make sure I play this. Let's play this just a moment. UCLA, this is a Gaza solidarity march that got broken up where two sides ended up sort of in contrast with each other.
Listen to what I'm telling all of you. Long live Israel. There ain't nothing you're gonna do about it. Nothing. You couldn't do anything then. You ain't gonna do anything now. Show your face. Show your face. Hey.
Jelani, this is one of the few protests where it did get violent, where the two groups actually came together, clashed, used a lot of naughty words being thrown, a lot of bad words, and the N-word was being thrown, et cetera. Mm. So you're now starting to see when the protesters are allowed to sort of interact, it gets worse.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the important things that, you know, at least in earlier iterations of this, is that we often saw protests in which there were pro-Palestinian, you know, groups and pro-Israeli groups separated by a narrow divide, but people largely kept it to chants and chanting at each other. I think as things have intensified, it's what you saw there. Yeah.
I think we have to have a larger conversation about the ways in which these universities are very much a part of the military-industrial complex. I mean, these students are not making it up that these schools are in partnership in many ways with military companies, defense contractors. There's a lot of that, if you could very briefly.
Yeah, I mean, well, that's the kind of historic thing. That's always been kind of, if you go back to 1968, we were talking about the parallels between 1968 and now.
Yeah.
That large protest began precisely because of Columbia's involvement with an organization that was doing defense research for Vietnam. Yeah. But, so that's not a novel development, but it's a thing that we have to be really concerned about.
I want to have more conversation about that on this show because I think it's important. Professor Noel McAfee, thank you so much for joining me. Jelani Cobb, my friend, thank you very much. Up next on The Readout, the second week of arguments in the first ever criminal trial of a sitting president starts tomorrow, and we're expecting Trump's lawyers to continue his go-to strategy of never giving an inch of his so-called enemies. The Readout continues after this.
Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood, which means affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control our bodies and get the health care we need has been stolen from us. And now, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves health care. It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, we can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
When Donald Trump enters a New York City courtroom tomorrow for his second week in front of a 12-member jury in his first criminal trial, he's surely hoping that his lawyers continue following his lead and that of his former mentor, Roy Cohn, who taught him the strategy of deflect, distract, never give in, and most of all, admit no wrong. Of course, that strategy hasn't appeared to go too well for Trump's defense team so far. During last week's hearing on whether Trump violated his gag order at least 10 times, Trump's lawyer, Todd Blanche, claimed that counter to what was clearly evident by Trump's actions on potential trial witnesses, that, quote, President Trump is being very careful to comply with your honor's rules, unquote. That led to a stern response from Judge Juan Marchand. You, Mr. Blanche, you are losing all credibility. I have to tell you that right now you are losing all credibility with the court. Mind you, that exchange came on only the second day of the jury being seated in what is expected to be a weeks-long trial. As the New York Times points out, as the trial grinds on in the weeks ahead, legal experts said the defense team will need to walk a fine line to appease both of its audiences, 12 jurors and a singular defendant. Trying the case to your client's vanity rather than to the jury is a losing game, said J. Bruce Maffeo, a former federal prosecutor. Joining me now is Harry Littman, former U.S. attorney and senior legal affairs columnist for the Los Angeles Times, and Doug Jones, former Alabama senator and former U.S. attorney, who is currently a distinguished senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. Thank you both for being here. Harry, I will start with you at the table. It does seem that Todd Blanche was kind of hamstrung by trying to please Donald Trump. I mean, all of the sort of weirdness of calling him President Trump when he's not the president and just insisting on using that terminology and saying he did no wrong, he did nothing wrong. All of it just seems to be for Trump's benefit. How well do you think that's working out for them in the trial?
So far, not very. And I think it's only going to get worse. Look, we talked about Roy Cohn. Trump, we often compare it to a mob boss. But even when a mob boss is under indictment and goes to see his Roy Cohn says, all right, shut up and listen to me now. I know what needs to happen. We're going to go there and say, maybe you haven't lived an exemplary life, but this charge and that charge. They can't do that with Trump. And what it means is they're going to have to say he never had an affair with McDougal. He never slept with Stormy. And all in all, for the jury, I mean, it's one thing for him to deflect and deny, but there are 12 people there who are judging his credibility. And
yeah.
Can everyone be lying here? Imagine the cross-examination they're going to have to do on Stormy Daniels. It's the wrong way to cross. They're just going to have to call her a flaming liar. They tried to assume the same for Pecker. It's a terrible strategy.
If they know that they're lying, isn't that some sort of misconduct on the part of the lawyers?
That's very interesting. If they know that, well, I mean, they won't say.
They know it's a lie.
Yeah. Well, they can't, you know, they can't suborn perjury.
Yeah.
But the perjury here would be from Donald Trump. And I don't think we're going to see him testify. They can suggest to that Daniels, well, you're making this up, aren't you? But there's only so far they can go.
Yeah.
And it'll just, in front of a jury, it'll look like they're badgering her and the like. They're
and
stuck.
Also, his whole image from the 1980s is just a witness against him. Of course he did it.
Right.
Let me go to you, Doug Jones. This was Donald Trump's complaint last week that he was stuck in court.
These are all Biden trials. This is done as election interference. Everybody knows it. I'm here instead of being able to be in Pennsylvania and Georgia and lots of other places campaigning. And it's very unfair.
Today is Monday. There is no court today. I doubt Donald Trump is campaigning, or nor is he probably with Melania, because let's just be honest, she doesn't want to hang out with him. It's clear. Here's what he did the days that he did not have court last week. Wednesday, golf. Saturday, golf. Sunday, golf. He does have a couple campaign events this Wednesday in Wisconsin and Michigan, but up to now, he has not utilized his time when he's not in court to campaign. Your thoughts?
You know, the thought that I had when I first heard that comment, when he said he was supposed to be in North Carolina, he was supposed to be in Pennsylvania. Well, no, He's supposed to be in court. He's a criminal defendant, and he is required to be in court. Maybe he would like to be in North Carolina, but I don't know, and I bet Harry would agree. I've never seen a criminal defendant who didn't want to be anywhere the hell else other than sitting in a court with the United States of America or the state of X saying that you're on trial for a crime. So, you know, look, I really think that that's just playing to the cameras. Donald Trump is going to do what Donald Trump wants to do on the weekends. He will campaign some. What's striking to me is how little campaigning he's actually doing, as opposed to President Biden, who is traveling across this country, you know, two or three times a week. It's really stunning the way they have picked up the pace of their travels. And Donald Trump's not doing that. He wants to campaign by complaining about the trial, and that's it.
Doug Jones, you prosecuted Klansmen. Did any of them ever fall asleep in court while you were prosecuting them?
You know, I didn't look over. I didn't pay any attention, but I doubt it seriously. You know, those kind of cases, any kind of case, a defendant more than probably just about anybody is acutely aware of the circumstances and acutely aware of what they are facing. There's no one else in that courtroom that is facing what that criminal defendant is facing. And you better be on top of your game, because I know that Todd Blanche is a good lawyer, and I am confident that he has told his client, this jury is going to be watching you every second. They're going to be watching you even when they're supposed to be watching the judge or a witness. And so you've got to make sure that you have the right demeanor, you stay alert, and because your body language, he may not testify, but his body language tells it all.
Same to you, Harry Lipman. I mean, have you ever seen a defendant in such a high profile case where he could go to jail, fall asleep?
Yeah. I mean, look, I was in court. And so you could see the jury see Trump and see the attentiveness. Obviously not. It shows. I think who knows what's going through his mind and what medication he's taking and the like. But obviously any lawyer would, you know,
nudge him. What was interesting is that having been in the courtroom that the day that I was there, too, it is interesting to watch the jurors really play ping pong. They really do watch whoever's testifying. And then they keep looking back over at
taking
Donald
notes.
Trump and they're taking notes. They're not falling asleep. Like, they're actually very attentive. Did you get any signals to any of the particular witnesses being of interest to them when you were sitting there?
Well, I think they really were focused on, you know, Pecker is a weird guy, a kind of a scoundrel, but I thought he played it like an open book, and they were attentive to him, and they were very attentive on the redirect. The last part when the DA was there, you could see him go a little bit more in their seats.
Yeah.
There's been a lot of preview about Michael Cohen.
Absolutely.
I'm sure when he comes, they'll be focused hard.
Doug Jones, there's an April 23rd gag order hearing, and then there's a Thursday gag order hearing that's coming up. What do you anticipate happening here? Because Donald Trump is notoriously difficult to restrain. What do you expect this judge to do?
You know, I think it's hard to say. I don't see that this judge right now is going to in any way put him in custody. But I do think he'll talk to him. I do think he will say, you know, you are stretching the court's limits here with what you have done. I think he will find that he violated the gag order. It seems pretty clear to, I think, just about anybody that's ever been in a criminal case that he has violated the gag order and likely done it intentionally. And that's where I think his lawyer got into some problems with the court when he said he was trying his best to comply. Pretty clear that he's trying his best to goad this judge into doing something. And that could be a problem. But I don't think this judge will take the bait. I think he wants to get this trial through and proceed. Nothing has happened. Yeah. And I think he's going to just have a stern talking.
Harry Lipman and former Senator Doug Jones, thank you both very much. And coming up, since 2016 will literally never end, Republicans who once took abuse from Trump and questioned if he was fit for the presidency are now groveling at his feet. That's next.
Shh.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. In fact, Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/podcastfree. All lowercase, shopify.com/podcastfree, shopify.com/podcastfree.
Hey, it's Chris Hayes. This week on my podcast, Why Is This Happening?, author Ari Berman on his new book, Minority Rule, The Right-Wing Attack on the Will of the People and the Fight to Resist It.
If we're going to be at a moment in time when so many people are saying we have to understand the Constitution as it was intended, then we have to understand that it was intended to check democracy, not to expand it. And we can have such a view of the Constitution that says that all of these institutions are so amazing when it's so obvious that they made a lot of mistakes and that a lot of it needs to be corrected.
That's this week on Why Is This Happening? Search for Why Is This Happening wherever you're listening right now and follow.
The problem with Ron DeSanctimonious is that he needs a personality transplant, and those are not yet available.
You know what the expression I said? He's like a wounded bird falling from the sky. Oh, there he is. It's Ron DeSanctimonious. He's falling beautifully from the sky. It's a beautiful thing to watch.
Ron DeSanctimonious was walking off the stage, and his feet, it's weird, because his cowboy boots. So they have a high heel outside, but inside you got a big deal going on. And he's walking like... No, he's walking off the stage like he's trying to balance himself. I thought he was wearing ice skates.
He's like a wounded bird falling from the sky. After spending the better part of the past year being publicly mocked and humiliated by Donald Trump on the campaign trail, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis appears to be ready to grovel at the feet of his former primary rival. Trump and DeSantis met privately in Florida this weekend to bury the hatchet and talk about how they can work together ahead of the November election. For Trump, the truce appears to be purely for financial reasons. According to the Washington Post, Trump's advisors hope DeSantis will tap his donor network to help raise significant sums of money, because as we all know, Trump really needs it. While DeSantis is apparently just looking out for his own political future. And if history has any indication, it's now only a matter of time before DeSantis, or DeSanctimonious, or whatever he's calling himself now, probably because Trump wants him to, adds his name to the long list of Republicans who went from challenging or opposing Trump to publicly degrading themselves on his behalf, joining the likes of Lindsey Graham, Ted Cruz, and Tim Scott. Joining me now is Matthew Dowd, former Republican strategist and MSNBC senior political analyst. What's the over-under on how long till Ron DeSantis starts calling himself Ron DeSanctimonious?
I don't know that over-under whether he's going to apply the label, but what's the over-under on how quickly he's out there campaigning for Donald Trump? My guess is five days.
A few days.
In the course of this. And you could add in your list of people that have groveled. Marco Rubio is also on that list of people
Have groveled. Yeah.
In the course of this. I mean, what's amazing to me, this is a political party, the Republicans, that have run on this constant strength of manhood, and we're the party of strength, and this is who we are. Nobody's going to tell us what to do. And they're the weakest people with a lack of moral fiber of any I've ever seen in the course of this. They have no sense of themselves or no sense of pride in their own thing. They're willing to do whatever it takes. I don't get what it gets them, but I think at this point, and maybe we'll talk about this thing in the next segment as well, is that one of the benefits that Donald Trump has provided America is he's the great revealer. Mm-hmm. And what Donald Trump has done in not only in America as a whole and revealed what we need to fix in our country and all of the things that we need to fix, he's revealed people's true character.
Indeed.
That's what he fundamentally revealed. He's revealed Bill Barr's character. He's revealed Marco Rubio's character. He's revealed all these people's fundamental true character. And actually, that's a benefit so we can see who they really are.
It's a parade of beta males. Here's Bill Barr, then versus now.
In that context, I made it clear I did not agree with the idea of saying the election was stolen and putting out this stuff, which I told the president was.
You're voting for someone who you believe tried to subvert the peaceful transfer of power, that can't even achieve his own policies, that lied about the election even after his attorney general told him that the election wasn't stolen. And as the former chief law enforcement in this country, you're going to vote for someone who is facing 88 criminal counts.
Well, look, the 88 criminal counts, a lot of those are, in my, and I've said...
Even if 10 of them are accurate.
The answer to the question is yes.
Beta male number two, Lindsey Graham, in 2016, he said if we nominate Trump, we'll get destroyed and we deserve it. Here's him now.
If he is convicted, you will still support him and vote for him.
Absolutely. I think what's going on with Donald Trump is weaponization of the law. He's being prosecuted in Manhattan, one of the deepest blue state cities in the country.
And beta male number three, J.D. Vance. He compared Donald Trump to Hitler in a text to his former roommate. He wrote, I go back and forth between thinking Trump might be a cynical a-hole like Nixon, who wouldn't be that bad, or he might be America's Hitler. He is also called Trump loathsome and an idiot. And now here is J.D. Vance this past Sunday on Fox.
I was wrong. I didn't think he would be a good president. He was a great president. That's not about, you know, sinking to political degradation. That's looking at reality and recognizing that Donald Trump was a success.
Is this just that they were sort of always betas who were faking alpha, or is it capitulation because they think he'll be an autocrat and they want to get, they want to supplicate themselves before him in advance because they're afraid of him and what he might do with his authority when he gets back in, if he gets back in?
Can I answer yes to both of those? Because I think submission, being a beta male, and that's who you always are, is also one of the requirements of submitting to an autocrat. Sure. And not standing up to him. And so they basically are the same thing in the course of this. I also think what it says is these people, no matter what they have lectured other people on about America or faith or religion or whatever, have no core moral principles, have zero core moral. And that's what we've discovered in this. All the things they repeat out there for crowds and quoting the Bible and all the thing about being honest and truthful and all that is all a big lie. It was never something they fundamentally believed. They only said it because they thought it would benefit them politically. And now in this case, they're doing the exact same thing, which is going along with Donald Trump because they think it's going to benefit him politically. So yes to both your questions, they are both that, but they have no moral sense.
Well, they're also beta females as well. And I think the thing that people don't understand is that Donald Trump despises these people. He reportedly is sick of Carrie Lake already. He doesn't respect any of these people. He despises them because of their weakness and their capitulation. Really quick, your quick thoughts.
Well, I think he despises them the same way he despises his own voters.
Absolutely.
His own voters. He has no care about. He would not hang out with them if he wasn't at a crowd and all that. He despises them, even though he constantly says he's their advocate. He despises them. He despises the elected officials and he despises the voters.
Absolutely. And we're going to talk about one more of them on the other side of the break. Matthew Dowd is going to stick with us because somehow Kristi Noem, speaking of beta females, is doubling down on her alpha decision to kill her dog. Yeah, that's next. Kristi Noem is not exactly a household name. She's the governor of South Dakota and a former unremarkable congresswoman for that state. But her name is now popping up for all the wrong reasons. Four of South Dakota's federally recognized Native American tribes have barred Noem from their lands after she claimed, without evidence, that Mexican drug cartels had a foothold on their reservations and were committing murders there. She's grown very close to Donald Trump and even closer with some of his political allies like Corey Lewandowski. Noem is on the short list to become the new Hang Mike Pence, a.k.a. Trump's running mate, and she's hawking a new book to help her sell herself to the country. The Guardian got a hold of that book and found out that Noem is the proud killer of what she described as an untrainable puppy, which she says she hated. Now, normally, killing puppies would be the opposite of a political calling card, but weirdly enough, the poor little monster is not the only animal Noem has killed. She said she also killed an uncastrated goat who was bothering her children. Noem apparently thinks this story shows Americans that she's willing to do the tough things like killing puppies. When the predictable outrage ensued, she defended herself on social media, writing, "We love animals, but tough decisions like this happen all the time on a farm. Sadly, we just had to put down three horses a few weeks ago that had been in our family for 25 years. Red rum." That with me is Matthew Dowd. You're a political strategist. Make it make sense to me how killing puppies is a thing that you think makes you better and more attractive as a politician.
Well, this leads back to the previous conversation. I mean, I just think what we're seeing is this, unfortunately, this toxic, you know, place that exists in parts of America, including in parts of our elected officials, that is revealed in the course of this. I mean, we all know, any rational human being knows her actions are despicable. She's deplorable. She's Cruella de Vil from the Dakotas. That's who she is. And by the way, I warn anybody, don't take Dalmatians to South Dakota anytime soon.
Please.
In the course of this. But what it says, I think, more fundamentally about the Republican Party is these people believe in the ends justify the means. And it even goes as far as killing pet animals. I mean, think about that. It is, I'll lie if lying is going to achieve my goal. I'll obstruct our democracy. I'll, you know, steal documents. I'll pay off porn stars. I'll do all of these things if it achieves a fundamental goal. And I think how despicable her behavior is, I think she deep down believes that she can do whatever she wants to do if it's in some service of whatever she thinks it is, including killing a pet dog, which she believes is unruly. I guess she didn't think there was an option of giving it away or giving it to a shelter, which I'm sure would have been welcome to take it. And I think that the other part about that, this, I think, is even more outrageous, is she's proud of it.
Yeah.
And talk to anybody that's had to put down an animal for some health reason or some other reason, it stays with them the rest of their life.
That's
it
right.
It stays with them the rest of their life. She's proud that she did that.
You know, what's wild is that, you know, it was, I'm old enough to remember when Mitt Romney, you know, part of what really destroyed him in the election when he was running against President Obama is that he put his dog Seamus on the roof of their car to travel from state to state, which people thought was an absolute horror. But this woman is talking about what we would normally consider serial killer behavior, you know, people who kill animals like repeatedly and repeatedly, which she keeps bragging, she keeps doing. Like, that's what we normally think of as serial killer behavior. She actually thinks, and Mary Trump has said, that she thinks it will appeal to Donald Trump because he does like people who are needlessly cruel. And so she may be right that this makes her more attractive to Trump.
Well, I think it would appeal to Trump, who he is, like, oh, that's great. But I think Donald Trump is smart enough to know that I'm not going to put a dog puppy killer on the ballot. It could hurt me. So I think he would slap her high five and say, oh, that's neat that you did that. But, by the way, you're not going to be on the ticket. Because I think once you do that, speaking of the NFL draft, you go from the first round to not being drafted by anybody once you're identified as a puppy killer.
It's kind of amazing the things that these Republicans think make them attractive. Ron DeSantis, 6-week abortion ban, Kristi Noem being so cruel and horrible to the indigenous tribes in your state that they say, get out, never come to our lands. You know, you go on and on. You know, the governor of Iowa, 6-week abortion ban, even Brian Kemp, 6-week abortion ban. They actually think cruelty helps them.
Yeah, I think they think cruelty is, it's not a bug. It's part of the system.
It's part
That's
of the party.
What they think is what their party wants. And just think of how they talk about other people. And they're proud of the fact that they say the course is cruelest things to people, that they send police officers to beat up people. They
Absolutely.
Think that's a neat thing to do. And they're, and the sad part, Joy,
right.
is there's a element of American society and it
Absolutely.
Occupies the Republican Party that actually likes it.
I will note that Tate Reeves, the governor of Mississippi, has declared May to be Confederate Heritage Month while banning the teaching of Black history. And by the way, Tate Reeves, you're welcome to come on this show and explain to us how that dichotomy works. Please come on and please explain it to us. Educate us. Matthew Dowd, thank you, my friend. Very much appreciated. All right, guys, don't go anywhere. We have a very special announcement coming up next. Okay, I am really excited to announce a very special program coming up this weekend on MSNBC. My friend and colleague Rachel Maddow joins me in a conversation from New York's historic Apollo Theater about my best-selling book, Medgar and Merle. Here is a preview. This is a time that is very much like Medgar Evers' time. And so we have to ask ourselves, how did people at that time respond to that? What did they do when they were faced with the same things we did? You know what they did? They voted. They voted anyway. And because they understood that, as King said, you may not be able to get the racist sheriff to stop being racist towards you or change his mind, but you can vote him out. Mm-hmm. And in the end, I think what people have to remember is that the vote
and using the vote is actually the strongest and most powerful tool that you have.
We had a fantastic discussion and a terrific turnout at the Apollo. Be sure to watch Joy Reid and Rachel Maddow live at the Apollo Saturday night at 9 p.m. Eastern, right here on MSNBC and streaming on Peacock. And that is tonight's readout.
MSNBC is going to be live here all night.
Today's news requires more facts.
Palestinians and Israelis are blaming each other for the tragedy that has inflamed the region.
More analysis.
Most of the states with the worst rates of gun deaths are ones where Republicans control the state government.
And more perspective.
This is not just about women and pregnant people in Texas. This is about people across this country.
The world's never been harder to understand. That's why it's never been more important to try. MSNBC. Understand more.